You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In just over a week's time, Robert Spanu will start his tenure as President of the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. He's not only a practising jurist and judge, he was also Dean of the Law Faculty at the University of Iceland before becoming a judge at the European Court of Human Rights in November 2013. Robert, we're very lucky to catch you at this strange and busy time. Just before we get on to the substance of our discussion, what arrangements are you having to put in place to take up your position at the head of the Strasbourg Court?
Thank you, Rosalind, and thank you for having me on. Well, we are now in the phase of transition. The current president is still in office, so we are working closely together in a difficult time, as you can imagine. Attempting to organize matters in the court, our work procedures. We have been working since the lockdown in France, basically teleworking or working online, which has succeeded quite well, I must say. We have kept up productivity in the court to an acceptable level, considering the circumstances. And now I am in the process of preparing to take over, as you mentioned, on the 18th of May.
Going back to lockdown, you were due to deliver, and indeed did deliver from social distancing, a course in artificial intelligence and the rule of law. And the substance of your paper was rapid advances in artificial intelligence will not just require new legal and regulatory responses. AI will also fundamentally alter the institutional capacities and legitimacy of courts. How will AI reshape our understanding and implementations of law, Robert?
Well, I think inevitably they will, and indeed they already have. We know that legal decision-making by governments, and I'm going to focus here a bit on governmental decision-making, because, of course, algorithmic or automated decision-making permeates our society at all levels, of course, vis-a-vis private actors as well. But if we focus on the way in which government decides matters in our lives, it is clear that governments have increasingly over the past few years, for basically costs reasons, because it is quite efficient to use automated decision making for what one can call bulk decision making, where you have hundreds and even thousands of decisions that need to be taken, by using algorithmic or computerized codes as sort of a context or a tool in which to decide very often very important issues, which has an effect on human beings. So the way in which the challenges we are facing is how do we accommodate or how do we protect rule of law oriented principles, which have been are the foundations of a democratic and rule of law oriented society, when we move from human decision making, which allows for accountability, which allows for transparency, and which allows for also discretionary elements to come into play to safeguard equity and justice, how can we safeguard and protect these fundamental principles in an age, in a development where we are more and more using automated decision making in deciding trajectories of people's lives? So that is the core challenge the law will face. To what extent can these two, one can say, competing paradigms be accommodated so as not to forsake and sacrifice the gains we have made in the constitutional orders of post-Second World War Europe and in many other parts of the world for allowing government to, for cost purposes and efficiency purposes, to use these kinds of tools?
I mean, it's particularly relevant in times of plague where we think of the analogy of AI being used as a diagnostic tool for disease. Now, of course, we want that because it's more accurate and the data processing powers are far greater. Why do we not want it for legal processes?
I mean, I think that is an extremely good analogy. As you say, I'm pretty sure when it comes to disease, we don't really care about transparency, accountability, or the legitimacy of the diagnostic process so long as the rate of success is as close to 100%. We want the diagnostic process when it comes to whether we are sick or not to actually find the truth. And the truth is an objective entity when it comes to diagnosing disease. But how is this different in the law? It's different because the end result in the law, whether a right exists or not, if we take in particular the human rights field, which is the one that I focus on, of course, there are multiple manifestations of the way in which algorithms can impact law, but if we focus on human rights law, the question whether a right exists or not, whether a person is convicted or not, is to a large extent morally and societally acceptable on the basis of certain rule of law principles. We ask ourselves, one, a person must be able to know who took the decision, the principle of accountability. Secondly, we require that a person must know on what factual and legal basis the decision has been taken. This is simple transparency and legitimacy of the decision-making process. And finally, in the law, as we know, it is all about justification and maintaining equilibrium, equality, that decisions, similar decisions affecting person A are also taken in the same manner and on the same basis for person B. That is a core fundamental underlying principle to retain the integrity of law. So this, at the end of the day, a person must be able to know why the decision was taken and to what extent the decision compares to other similar decisions, the principles of justification and non-discrimination. Now, when it comes to algorithmic tools, they are inherently in tension with these concepts. Why? Because, for example, it is very difficult for the person who is the subject of a decision taken by an automated tool to understand how the tool works. What are the data sets, we call them data sets, that have been incorporated into the algorithmic tool, the code which has been programmed to be able to digest an infinite amount of data sets. So it all depends on the interaction between the algorithmic tool, the code, and the data set that is put into the algorithm to process. Now, the way that is done, the way the system works, is very difficult to explain, even to the most technically proficient people, and not to speak of, not to disparage you and me, Rosalind, but we are lawyers. We are perhaps not, certainly not me, technically proficient in understanding the fundamentals of coding for algorithmic purposes. So that really creates a tension when a person receives a decision promulgated by government, where in fact no human has actually taken part in the decision-making process. And there again, also, there is the problem of the bias, which is inherent in the choice of the data set going into the algorithm. Because it's, of course, clear that the choice of data used for algorithm purposes is a choice made by humans. So the way in which that process takes place is also an important part of the overall integrity of this process. So at the end, that is the core difference. The core difference is we may not morally, we may not democratically, we may not, for the purpose of human rights, have problems with using algorithmic tools when the end result is black and white, when the end result is an objective truth, like whether I have cancer or not. differently from, well, whether my freedom of expression should be limited, or indeed whether, for example, as we see, whether algorithmic or a government is deciding on whether I am a high-risk person, for example, when it comes to predictive analysis of criminal behavior, when it comes to, you know, whether social benefits should be limited to a particular person, or there is a risk that a particular person will abuse benefits provided by government, and the government uses algorithmic predictive analysis for those purposes. So this development is in its infancy, and we have a lot of work to do in the law to be able to grapple with the paradigm that is emerging.
I just want to take you to two cases that you mention in your course. One, a case from America, Loomis and Wisconsin. What happened there? It was a 2016 case, wasn't it?
Yes, and there we have a very interesting case. As you said, this case is called State v. Loomis. This is a judgment of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It deals with the question whether, in the enforcement of a judgment, whether predictive analysis about the risk of recidivism by a person can be taken into account in the sentencing process. And there we're, of course, dealing with a legal system, the American legal system, which is in some ways different from the European system, the European human rights framework, because we have a very robust principle of due process under American constitutional law. And of course, we also have in European human rights law the principle of the right to a fair trial. But in this case, the question was whether, one, this predictive tool was sufficiently regulated by state law, because in the US, criminal law is reserved to the states, that the states themselves regulate criminal behavior in accordance with state law. And the second issue was whether the predictive tool could be really the one and only tool used, or whether it could only be a facilitator, one element in a more global assessment of the individual situation of the person involved. The court found that this was acceptable, this tool, because it was only one element to facilitate a decision maker, the judge, to make an overall analysis. What this tells us is that, yes, in that context, it was considered to be okay because the predictive tool was not the one and only, the ultimate decision maker in the case, which also tells us, a contrario, that it would be problematic if an algorithmic tool in that kind of scenario was basically a full substitute for the decision that is supposed to be taken by a human.
I mean, obviously, different set of circumstances altogether. The other case you mention in the Hague District Court in February this year, the decision went the other way, the use of algorithmic systems to identify possible benefits, fraudsters. This was considered to be in breach of the right to privacy. Could you tell us a bit about that case?
This is a very interesting case. I would, however, say, Rosalind, that here I have to be a bit careful. The reason is that at this point, I do not have information whether the judgment is actually final, whether it's on appeal. So potentially, it could, of course, end up in my court. So let me just talk in general about the issue here. No, the issue there was the use by the Dutch government and, if I recall correctly, municipalities in using an algorithmic tool or a risk indicator to assess the potentiality, as you mentioned, of fraud and abuse within the social benefit system. And there was a range of data which could be incorporated into this predictive tool. And basically all personal information which individual government departments had would potentially be incorporated without any consent on behalf of the person in question. The district court found that the main problem with this system was the lack of domestic regulation. So basically, Dutch law does not regulate the use of such a tool for these purposes, which, according to the district court, was not in conformity with Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the right to private life, because of the fact that this is the collection and storage of data and the use of personal data without a sufficient regulatory environment so as to detect the dangers and compensate for those dangers within the system itself. So here you have, I think, a more regulatory approach to the issue than if we compare this case to State v. Loomis, where I think the lack of a regulatory framework was not as front and center, but we see that that is really at the forefront in the Dutch case. And I think the reason there is rather simple. The core difference between European human rights law and American constitutional law is that in Europe, under the European Convention, we have long recognized positive obligations of states. So states have to be proactive in creating a human rights-friendly regulatory framework. That is less so under American constitutional doctrine, where it is primarily based on the state's negative obligation not to interfere with fundamental rights, which also are, we can say, under the American Bill of Rights, are not as developed textually as in Europe. And the best example, of course, is the right to private life, which is not in the Bill of Rights under the Constitution of the U.S., whereas it is clearly front and center in the European Convention on Human Rights.
Staying with the right to privacy, I'm sorry to keep bringing this discussion back to the plague, but in this country, we are developing all sorts of AI-based systems to contact and trace people via their phones, Bluetooth, and so on, in order to measure the level and location of infections. What are the privacy implications of this?
That is, of course, an extremely topical question. And again, you are speaking to a judge. You're speaking to a judge of the European Court of Human Rights, who will, at least my court, I think it's clear, will be seized of these issues in the foreseeable future. So I will be careful in how I answer. I think it's fair to say, and it goes without saying, that the use of measures like that will have to conform to Article 8 of the Convention. I mean, that's clear. Therefore, the issues that we have mentioned, the regulatory framework, the fact that in the framework there are counterbalancing measures taken to safeguard and prevent the abuse of such measures, there really needs to be a very thoughtful process of deliberation about the use of such techniques. It's clear that no one calls into question that at the prima facie level, the government must consider this to be based on a legitimate aim. The aim, of course, is to create tools to prevent spread of disease and to facilitate active quarantining and contact tracing. So the question is more of balance. It is more of proportionality. It is more of regulation. And I think all of these elements will, and I'm certainly sure that they are now being considered by all those that are contemplating of using these types of measures.
More broadly, I know you have to be careful in what you say and predict, but do you foresee a wave of challenges to government action as a consequence of lockdown once things return to normal?
I don't want to take a position on that clearly. I would only say, will there be challenges? I think that is inevitable. The pandemic has immense implications for democracy, rule of law, and human rights. We are faced with an extremely difficult tension between the necessities of safeguarding the public interest and adopting measures which have consequences for individual lives. And in that kind of scenario, it is clear that there will be disputes. There will be disputes where we are drawing the line and whether the line is drawn accurately for the purposes of existing laws. It will be for, of course, firstly, for our representatives in politics, those that are elected to make the initial determination of the rules and norms we will apply to make these determinations. The executive branch needs also to implement those laws in a fair and proportionate manner. And then at the end of the day, when disputes arise, whether it will be a wave, I don't want to use that term, there will be challenges. It will be for national judges at the outset to decide whether in accordance with their national laws. And in Europe, the member states of the Council of Europe, judges within those member states, in accordance with the convention, whether measures that have been taken are in conformity with human rights laws. And ultimately, it will be open to those that feel that decisions at national level are not favorable or they disagree with them to bring an application to Strasbourg. I also don't exclude at all that the issues will arise within the context of EU law. I think those are the two jurisdictions, international jurisdictions, which will quite clearly be implicated by the legal consequences of the pandemic.
We've moved away from the central subject of AI. Do you have anything more that you want to say about algorithms and regulation and lawmaking?
Well, let me just end with a couple of conceptual points, which I think, for me at least, have been useful when I've been thinking and reflecting about this issue. The first is that algorithmic decision-making, legal decision-making, I think it's useful to differentiate between two types of problems. The first is problems with the actual process of decision-making. I have called this the problem of form. How is the process itself implicated by algorithms? The second is what I've called the problem of substance, which is how does the tool actually affect human rights and fundamental freedoms? It is, I think, they're of course closely linked, but I think it's useful to make that distinction, for example, when dealing with regulatory processes. How do you regulate algorithms? The second conceptual point that I would make is, I think it's important to make the following distinction. One is algorithm or automated decision making only used as a facilitator, or is it used as a substitute? Those are, and again, State v. Loomis, the case I mentioned from the US, where it was accepted that algorithms could be facilitators, but they could not be substitutes. I think moving forward, governments and policymakers should take decisions in this field cautiously. There is a tendency to want to simply jump in and use algorithms almost exponentially without pausing and looking at, from the level of first principle, how we want to proceed so as to safeguard the rule of law principles that I mentioned at the outset.
So, Robert, thank you very much for coming to talk to us on LawPod UK, and very best of luck with starting your presidency at the European Court of Human Rights.
Thank you very much indeed, Rosalind. It's been a great pleasure.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.